a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a tea or a gin and tonic.
But not a toxin.
No, and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
What are we reading about today? What did we read? What are we talking about today?
Well, we're going to talk about the Notting Hill Mystery, which is potentially, you know, we've heard this several times and even in our own conversations, the first detective story, the first full-length detective story.
Are we saying that about each thing we're reading? It feels like we are.
We are. And the fun thing is we'll just continue it through the 19th century into the 20th century and
we'll
beyond.
Just continue it indefinitely.
This one's forever. The first one, 1963, 2008. This is the first one.
Well, that's interesting though. Maybe we shouldn't dive into that yet, because I know you have a summary, but I am kind of interested, like, why are every single one of these considered the first?
I think they each have their camps. They're people who are like, this is the book. This is the first one. This is it. And Notting Hill Mystery is, from beginning to end, a mystery. It's not about characterization. It's not about developing story per se. It's about figuring out crimes. And so from beginning to end, it's this thing that is going to be evolving, for another century and a half. And it's written in a way that is potentially interesting and also potentially difficult. And we're going to discuss that. But in many ways, a lot of the things that are done in this book, the way the evidence is analyzed and just, you know, the way it's captured, the way it's analyzed, the way it's discussed, very methodically, super detail-oriented, this is going to influence, I think, a lot of mysteries to come.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Especially the one we just did. The woman in white.
The woman in white. Yes. Yeah. Okay, well, let me go through the plot here in case you have not read this book, which you should if you get a chance. But Sarah and I are, you know, we're going to chat about the book, whether you've read it or not. So we appreciate your being here. But
yeah, it's quite short. You can read it if you're interested.
Yeah. okay. The story is set in London where a baron's wife dies after drinking acid while sleepwalking. Insurance investigator Ralph Henderson reviews the evidence and learns the Baron had taken out multiple life insurance policies on his wife. The investigator eventually concludes that the Baron is responsible for 3 deaths in total. All he has to do is prove it. To build his case, the investigator establishes a chain of connection between the Baron's wife and a woman named Mrs. Anderton. He goes back 27 years to the birth of twin girls. The girls have a morbid sympathy of constitution by which they suffer from each other's ailments. At age 6, the younger twin is kidnapped. Years later, the elder twin marries Mr. Anderton. So this is Mrs. Anderton. Henderson, the investigator, then reconstructs the chronology of events from when Mrs. Anderton and her husband become patients of the Baron, who is a famed mesmerist. The Baron conveys something called mesmeric fluid to Mrs. Anderton through the intervention of a clairvoyant named Rosalie. From the time Mrs. Anderson and Rosalie meet, it's obvious there's a psychic connection. The Baron learns that Rosalie is Mrs. Anderson's twin sister from long ago, and that Mrs. Anderton has £25,000. If she dies, the money goes to her husband. If her husband dies, the money goes to the twin sister. The Baron marries Rosalie, who is the twin sister. Rosalie takes ill due to poisoning. In fact, both Rosalie and Mrs. Anderton experience severe illness with the same symptoms at the exact same time. Seems the Baron is making Rosalie the conduit to Mrs. Anderton's eventual death by poison. When Mrs. Anderton eventually dies, Mr. Anderton is arrested on suspicion of murder. He commits suicide. Next, Rosalie dies by drinking acid. The case the investigator builds includes a map of the crime scene, medical and chemical analysis reports, eyewitness testimony, family letters, and diary entries. The investigator includes every salient detail, noting that the evidence is circumstantial and, quote, so delicate and complicated that the failure of a single link would render the remainder worthless, end quote. Ultimately, you, the reader, must decide if the evidence is enough to convict the Baron for insurance fraud and three murders.
I think before we get started today, we had a listener award to give out. There was a particular six-year-old. The youngest listener that we know of, is she 6 or 9?
6 years old.
Yes. Yeah. So we wanted to give an award to...
to Taya Seeberger. She is living in Switzerland outside Zurich currently, and she is our reader of the month.
Also one of our most international awards.
Yes. She and her mother, Caroline, and her father, Greg, were listening to our podcast in the car in Switzerland. So it's true, folks. We have gone global.
Taya will receive one of these amazing Teatonic and Toxin stickers. Yes. That she can stick on whatever she wants.
Maybe a nice book. Pride. One of her books or something.
My son sticks his stickers on just everything. I don't know what... He's 3. I think 6-year-olds are probably a little more sophisticated with their stickers. Mm-hmm. Nate pulled one out of his nose for the first time the other night.
It seems like some sort of commentary there. Maybe there was a...
These are big stickers. I don't think they'd get up in a nose, but maybe that's a challenge for someone out there.
Yeah, that makes them potentially less dangerous. We're not going to claim they're not dangerous, but...
No. Yeah. Don't put them in your nose.
They will not fit easily into the nose, I don't think.
Thank you, Taya.
Thank you, Taya. And thank you to Caroline and Greg Sherman as well for being listeners of our podcast. We appreciate you. And as I said, we're international now. So Switzerland, you know, who knows what's next?
I don't know what's next.
Yeah. Canada, Mexico. I mean,
Canada.
The sky is the limit. It's crazy. It's crazy. So, Sarah, we pivoted here. So we were going to talk about the Moonstone next, and
that's right. We tricked you, listeners.
We did, and in fact, I tricked Sarah.
I was,
and then
tricked.
We tricked all of you, and.
Here, I bought this Moonstone copy. I'm halfway through it. And Carolyn says, hey, can we switch? And I said, certainly.
And, you know, I was going to go either way. I wasn't going to fight too hard for it. But I kept seeing all these people writing that, you know, that the Nottingham Mystery is the first full-length detective novel. And it's an inverted mystery, meaning it's a how-done-it, not a who-done-it. And... so we know right off the bat who did it, but we're like, what happened? How did this whole thing come together? And so I was like, oh, if we could sort of wedge this in between, because we're moving chronologically. Can you talk about that a little bit, about the chronology here?
Absolutely. And that's kind of like, I'm pretty easy to convince. All you have to do is say, well, chronologically, it should go. And I think it probably should have gone before The Woman in White, actually, right?
I don't think so.
Really? Because they are like twin stories.
Yes, but chronologically, this comes after The Woman in White.
Really? That changes my opinion a lot.
Yeah.
That changes it a lot because this really seemed like The Woman in White, only both sisters get killed. both sisters in Hartwright would have died
sure.
in this story.
Yeah.
But I like going in chronological order, and mm-hmm. I think that this particular collection that you've curated here really lends itself to that, because we're looking at the development of the mystery novel.
Right.
There hasn't always been mystery novels, mm-hmm. and they developed over time. These sort of tropes took hold, you know, mm-hmm. one leads to another, and so... for me to read something in chronological order just adds a layer on that you can kind of absorb, you know, non-academically. You're just sort of absorbing it through reading, but you can kind of see the development and the next steps. And so when Carolyn said, hey, I'm reading a lot about this Notting Hill mystery, can we insert it? that made a lot of sense. But I'm actually shocked and amazed that this came after Woman in White. I need to Google that now.
So now I just checked the date in the book. It's 1865. I believe Woman in White is 1860. I believe The Moonstone is 1868.
Okay, because
I might have some of these dates wrong.
I'm Googling it right now.
We're Googling it live, people. We're doing our research live. Even though we're international now, we don't have people to do this
for
us.
Woman in White, written 1859.
Okay. So 59-60, I think, is probably.
And this was 60, you said?
Mm-mm. 65.
Really?
Yeah.
I have the worst copy of this, by the way.
She does. It's,
if you're watching this on a clip, don't get this copy.
It's in all italics, which is terrible.
It's one of those big flat books, and everything is italicized. I don't know. At first I thought this is a mistake, but then I still think it's a mistake.
It was poor judgment.
But I think it's a mistake of judgment. Mm. I reconciled myself, be like, well, I guess it's supposed to indicate it's all like written or handwritten or something, but it is not pleasant to read everything in italics on these giant pages.
So the copy to get is the British Library Crime Classics copy, which has a normal amount of italics, which is minimal, which is in life, italics should be minimally used.
Everything, the title, the author.
A little crazy.
Amazon sometimes has these weirdo editions. Yeah. So I didn't read the reviews. I was in a hurry.
Because I gave her and the listeners very little.
Well, not only that, but so I had this other copy, which I highly recommend. I did highly recommend eBay, where I got this Heritage Edition copy of The Moonstone.
Mm-hmm.
And I love Heritage Editions. And I thought, well, goodness, we're reading all these old books. I'll see if I can find some other cool copy on eBay. Well, they sent me the wrong book.
Yeah.
It wasn't even The Notting Hill Mysteries, a totally different book.
Okay.
And so then I had a shorter time to try and get this, and I just got the first thing on Amazon.
So one noticeable difference is my copy of The Notting Hill Mystery says author Charles Warren Adams, the author's name. He went by a pseudonym at the time of writing, Charles Felix, yes. And that's the name on hers. So,
but he was legitimately the king of Sardinia, right?
I did not know.
That's what meant. Charles Felix was the Duke of Savoy, Piedmont, Aosta, and King of Sardinia from 1821 to 1831.
Okay, well.
Born in Turin as the 11th child and 5th son. Born to Victor Amadeus III.
Wow.
So I thought, wow, the King of Sardinia wrote a mystery novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that Wilkie Collins lifted it. It was so similar to The Woman in White. I thought that's where you must have gotten it, but...
Or the lifting went the other direction.
Yeah, apparently.
Like, I love this Woman in White story. What if I took out all the characterization and...
Right. So instead of the count, here you have the Baron.
The Baron.
And instead of half-sisters, you have twin sisters.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like the personality of the Baron was even the same as the personality of the Count. They were both chemists.
Yeah.
They both, you know, you had these same people. They'd be like, he was the nicest person I ever met. He was also very overweight.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about how much he ate. Only the Baron likes to eat meat. The Count likes to eat pastry.
Yeah.
They're both amateur chemists. They're both amateur, like, they prescribe stuff. They're both amateur doctors. They just have all the manners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't think about all this. No.
I was, like, shocked. I was like, holy cow, Wilkie Collins would have been, like, really in trouble for plagiarism. But I guess that goes the other way.
Yeah. Well, you know, Charles Felix / Charles Warren Adams might have been.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
They're very different. So just to be clear, they're very different books, even though they have these similar...
The Count and the Baron.
Yeah. You know, The Woman in White really flushes out a number of characters.
Yes.
You like them, you don't like them, you feel for them, what have you, but you understand some things about them. It's harder in this book.
Yeah, you're really just reading these secondhand accounts. Like someone's compiled mm-hmm. all this and put it in a file.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it is, what's his name, Henderson?
Mm-hmm.
Compiled all this, put it in a file, and just kind of leaves it for you to decide.
Yeah, so it's an insurance investigator who's, from what I can tell, the most thorough
insurance investigator. Okay, so I didn't pick up that he was an insurance investigator.
He's an insurance investigator.
And so this is mostly about insurance fraud, folks.
It is. And so the thing that it reminds me of is what I enjoy listening to on Sirius XM on the classic station, Johnny Dollar.
I don't know what that is.
Johnny Dollar is an insurance investigator with an action-packed expense account.
Really?
Yes, he's amazing. And there's tons and tons of episodes and totally worth checking out. And so when I saw this guy was an insurance investigator, I was like, right on. Like, okay.
Yeah, he outwits literally 100% of people in the story.
Yeah, he is very detail-oriented. Now, to be fair, I had never heard of the Notting Hill mystery.
Mm-mm. No, not at all.
And on the surface, the story has all of the elements of many of the most gripping mysteries. It includes poisoning, an evil hypnotist, a girl kidnapped by gypsies, a series of murders that is, in the book is called In Their Nature, an Execution Too Horrible to Contemplate. And yet, in a lot of ways, it's not one of the most gripping mysteries. Super interesting. I loved the forensic detail. I loved the way the investigator pulled together every possible piece of evidence and then displayed it for we, the readers, to look at. The thing that felt really interesting about it and different is the way that the information's presented does not allow you into the interiority or the heads of any of the characters, including the investigator.
Yeah, there was just kind of a brief, one of the more brief ones that did have a diary. I believe it was Mrs. I find her name, Anderton.
Anderton. I kept wanting to call her Anderson.
Anderson or something. Anderton. Mm-hmm. But she has some diary entries mm-hmm. that I think feel a little more relatable. And again, that sort of reminded me of Woman in White.
Yeah.
Reverse reminded me, because this mm-hmm. one was first, the diary entries in that book
mm-hmm.
were the most relatable as mm-hmm. opposed to kind of the other collections of documents.
Yeah, we're presented with first-person accounts. We're presented with diary entries. We're presented with all kinds of fact-based information. And so you feel for some character simply because, I'm going to argue, because you know you're supposed to. So Rosalie, the twin sister, we don't want her to die. Mrs. Anderton, we don't want her to die. Mr. Anderton, from all evidence, loved his wife dearly, and he commits suicide when he is accused of killing his wife. Like, we don't want him to die. We can tell that he loves his wife, and yet we're sort of held at arm's length with all these characters.
Yeah, that was interesting. I feel like if we were in their heads, this is an extremely tragic story.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Woman in White, all these characters lived.
Yes. And,
that had a happy
most
ending.
Most of those characters.
Right. Yeah. Poor
Anne Catherick. Except for the poor Woman in White.
But most of the characters lived, whereas here everybody died and in really sad and preventable, frustrating ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, if we were in their heads, this would be a really different story mm-hmm. to go through. But having it just be sort of this collection of documentation keeps you at arm's length emotionally.
Emotionally, for sure. And so you almost feel like a forensic detective or really just somebody studying the a pile of evidence or something like that.
Yeah, I guess you are in the place of this insurance mm-hmm. investigator.
Yeah.
And I guess what a weird job that is. These yeah. tragic stories and lots of death.
So what happened is the Baron had taken out two life insurance policies on his wife, who just dies by drinking acid.
Which I didn't, a lot of this for me, it was mm-hmm. a little hard to pick up on.
Okay.
Until the very end when I realized, oh, she died from acid? I yes. guess that was earlier in the beginning, but that maybe that's kind of a side effect of like the way this was put together. And, mm-hmm. and maybe because my book was entirely in italics. And I had a really hard time.
That really must have added an extra layer.
It was another barrier of yeah, getting into it.
For sure. Yeah. So I think a lot of this would have felt new and eye-opening to a 19th century reading audience. They had not probably seen books like this. Evidence presented in such detail, the diary entries, letters, witness depositions. The British Library says that these innovative techniques would not become common features of detective fiction until the 1920s. So how did you feel, Sarah, about having all of these materials to comb through? Did you feel like a detective?
I didn't feel like a detective. Mm. I think I could have, you know, that's the thing about chronological order, mm-hmm. is I think at the beginning there is a certain amount of clunkiness mm-hmm. in people trying out these new ways to do things. Mm-hmm. If you were to write a book like this now, I think it would have really been smooth.
Yeah.
But doing it this way, I felt like a lot of stuff seemed really obvious, and mm-hmm. I had to like watch people kind of be doofuses about mm-hmm. it. And that was 100% mm-hmm. of people noted that Madame R, or I think Rosalie, her name, right?
Yeah.
Was afraid of her husband. Mm-hmm. 100% of people noted that. And yet they all disliked her and liked the husband. And I was like, yeah. Really? Yeah. Nothing speaks to you there.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Now, there were, to be fair, there were a couple characters that who did not like the Baron.
After they got to know him, yeah. Mrs. Anderton went from liking the Baron to... Mm-hmm. not liking him and preferring Rosalie.
And then there's the witness. I can't remember the guy's name. He lived in the same boarding house.
Yeah, like Aldridge or something.
Yeah, he's the one who presents information to the investigator and to the police about the Baron. So something caught his eye along the way, and he was like, this guy is not yeah. right.
Although he didn't dislike him as much as I thought he would mm. based on how they characterized Aldridge. He was mm-hmm. kind of just like, well, you know, he was really good to his wife. Never seen anybody like his wife more. That was like the deal. She seemed afraid of him, but I've never seen a nicer husband.
Yes.
Okay. Are we naive?
A little marital fear aside, it was all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was weird. That was weird for me.
Yeah.
So I feel like if this was written today, it would have been very well done. But as it was, a lot of stuff seemed really obvious and
yeah.
Interesting, but maybe not mysterious.
Yes, and so if it were done today, I think we would have been more surprised at the end as to how the Baron pulled off what he pulls off.
Yeah, that was an interesting aspect too.
Yeah, the mesmerism. He's a hypnotist essentially, and apparently like the most skilled guy in the world.
I would like to know more about like mm-hmm. as hypnotism mm-hmm. kind of emerged mm-hmm. as an art or pseudoscience at mm-hmm. the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think. Like, we would have, I don't know, been sort of eased into that, and we would have just sort of, like, figured it out along the way or suspected it, or there would have been some red herrings where we would not have known that he was the one doing it, and or in a more contemporary story, he might not have been the one who was doing it.
Yeah.
Rosalie would have been the, you know, evildoer the whole time or something like that. So in a contemporary story, things might have been shifted. And then I think also we would have been more emotionally connected to the characters. So my tribute to this book is that thankfully it was written so that other books could then, you know, beg, borrow, and steal from its structure and continue to evolve the form.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this case is an interesting one. It's based in large part on a series of potential coincidences, what in the book is called, could look like a mere chaos of coincidences. And it leads to a conclusion so at variance with all the most firmly established laws of nature that it seems almost impossible to accept. So essentially, Sarah, can you talk about like how this book, how this case is sort of wrapped up and what the investigator is basically putting in his report is this is what happened.
Yeah, so it seems like the Baron figured out he was just going along in his day-to-day life, mm-hmm. like hypnotizing people for health. And then a man frequently hypnotizing a lady was deemed like not appropriate. Mm-hmm. And so he has like this other intermediary.
Yeah.
So he like somehow hypnotizes her mm-hmm. and it passes on to Mrs.
Anderton.
I'm going to say Alderton. I'm getting all their Mrs. names like in a jumble in my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so then he finds out like, oh no, this is the long lost kidnapped sister. And how he finds that out with such ease when it's like a mystery to the rest of England.
including to her.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to bring up too. We can get to that. But anyway, mm-hmm. he puts two and two together and concocts this plan to murder everyone and get their money.
Yes.
So I don't know. It seemed really obvious, but you know, the writer kind of puts that towards you at the end, and mm-hmm. and the evidence does kind of rest on, is hypnotism real?
Yeah.
Oddly, what it doesn't rest on is, can one twin make another twin super sick? Like, everyone kind of buys that.
Yes.
So the deal is, whatever happens to Rosalie, Mrs. Alderton, feels even stronger. More strongly, and they just call it this sympathy between the twins.
Yeah.
I mean, twins are kind of mysterious. Do you know any?
Well, yes. So my boyfriend Michael has two sets of twins.
Oh, yeah. Do they have any mysteriousness about them?
I don't know. I'll have to ask them.
Are you a twin listener?
Yeah.
Do you have any mysterious stories?
You have to tell us.
I mean, USC twins have kind of this next level of connection, but for everyone to kind of be like, oh, yeah, the second one gets even more sick than the first one whenever the first one gets sick.
Yeah.
That seemed really easy for everyone to agree to, but nobody would believe in hypnotism, even mm-hmm. when they were being hypnotized.
So essentially what the Baron is doing is, okay, Rosalie is the long-lost twin sister of Mrs. Anderton, and the Baron is manipulating Rosalie every 2 weeks to be violently ill. And when Rosalie is violently ill, that illness transfers to Mrs. Anderton, who is in a different home, sometimes a different town.
Yeah, different town.
You know, sometimes in Notting Hill, sometimes not. But she's getting sick every 2 weeks because he's manipulating his wife, Rosalie, to become very sick. His goal is to get Rosalie just sick enough that Mrs. Anderton gets just sick enough that eventually Mrs. Anderton will die, but Rosalie will not, because he needs a progression of death where he needs Mrs. Anderton to die first, then he needs Mrs. Anderton's husband to die next, then he needs his own wife, the long-lost twin sister, to die third. It's this progression that will enable him to inherit the money. On the chance that the order is off and the wrong person dies in the wrong order, he's taken out two life insurance policies on his wife if she dies prematurely, he'll still get a small fortune. Or maybe a large fortune, actually. I think a large fortune.
Okay, and this was weird, too. Mm. I just have to say, maybe this is what feels dated or unbelievable. Mm. But Rosalie doesn't even seem to know she's the kidnapped sister. Mrs. Mm-hmm. Anderton doesn't know she's the kidnapped sister. Rosalie doesn't have a birth certificate. She doesn't go by the right name.
Right.
She goes by the name the gypsies gave her when they kidnapped her.
Yes.
The fact that he puts two and two together, how on earth would he collect on that policy and be like, oh, yeah, that's definitely her. This woman with no name that nobody knows about. That's her. Give me the £25,000.
I think he had some paperwork somewhere confirming birth.
He read the will, but I don't, and again, it could be the italics, but I don't recall.
Readers, if you're looking to keep key information from people in writing, just use italics.
It. It's hard to...
Pages of it.
It's really painful.
And people will be like, I'm sure this is nothing, no big deal, and they'll just go flip, 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 and go to the end.
The gypsies wouldn't have had a birth certificate. Mm-mm. How you could never make that connection. There's no documentation.
Right.
I mean, yes, it makes sense.
Right.
It adds up, but
yeah,
I don't think you could prove that to an insurance investigator.
No. And so, I mean, that gets to a question that I have about this book that kind of confused me. So some details seem immaterial to the story or to the case being built. Like, why was Rosalie kidnapped in the first place?
Because gypsies are like that.
Okay, but why did they take her? Like, why not? I don't know. They took her, but left her sister. How did the Baron ever meet Rosalie? Was it truly by chance? He went to the circus one day and said, you know, by Joe, I need to purchase this woman.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing I want to talk about.
I know. So, okay.
Well, they said at the end, she like looked in his eyes and it like screwed up her act. Mm-hmm. Like his eyes are a deal in this book. People don't know what color they are. They can't bear to look at them. They're extremely magnetic.
Yeah.
You look at his eyes. She looked at his eyes and she like fell off the tightrope or something. She was a tightrope walker.
Yeah. So he knew that he had sort of this
connection between them.
Yes. Mesmeric connection.
Yeah, and it is really clear that mesmerism doesn't work on everyone. It didn't work on Mr. Anderton at all, but it worked on his wife really strongly.
Very strongly, yeah. So, to be clear, so slavery was made illegal in England in 1807. Rosalie is sold twice in this book, once for £5 to a guy who runs a circus, and a second time for £50 to the Baron. Slavery was made illegal in England in 1807. Like, what's up with this?
I was thinking the same thing. And it connected in my mind, which I know we haven't discussed yet. Mm-hmm. But just a little foreshadowing for you readers. It connected in my mind to the Moonstone.
Mm.
Where it's like, oh, I stole something. That means it's mine. wouldn't anyone say, like, oh, this girl was sold at about the same time another one went missing?
Yeah.
And nobody says a thing. Like, yeah, I bought her.
Yeah.
And then I sold her.
Apparently it's the thing, like, buying and selling people, which I didn't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't know how it works when slavery is illegal and then it's made. Mm-hmm. Made illegal. Like, how does that phase out? And what was it like when it was legal?
Yeah, I guess I had all these open-ended questions. And some of these details were just not in the story because, you know, ostensibly, right, the investigator's putting together this case and stuff that doesn't need to be in the case isn't in it. Whereas in a more contemporary novel, we might flesh out the characters in a way where we answer them. And when they don't answer these kinds of questions, like in movies or TV shows, books, we get annoyed as readers and really watchers. Yeah.
Yeah. I just, the whole time I was like, wait, you're not looking very hard. A whole girl went missing. I actually, I felt really bad for these two sisters from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're writing letters to, I don't know if there's their aunt or great aunt or something.
Yeah.
And she, like, never actually shows up to look at them at all.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Her health isn't the best, yeah. And she's really busy and stuff. And so they're orphaned and just go
like
give them to somebody else.
She's the uncle in...
In Woman in White.
White.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah,
just
sort of
uninterested
like detached.
Guardian.
Yeah.
And so these poor girls are just given to this, they call her like a poor person of good character.
Yeah.
To be their guardian, and one gets stolen.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you know, I'm sure it's not her fault. Yeah. And nobody's looking very hard. And they're like, we searched and searched and then went home. So let's never mention her again.
Yeah. Which, and that's a great point. She is not mentioned again. So there's a lot of secrecy in this book, which is essential to the plot, you know? So, you know, Mrs. Anderton never talks about her missing sister. No one else mentions it. Oh, we don't want to upset her. We don't want to mention that. Mrs. Anderton, every 2 weeks, experiences this leaden taste in her mouth, and she doesn't tell anyone.
Yeah, she seemed to, because the leaden taste, the first time, cued them on to the antimony poisoning.
Yeah.
And then, which cued them on to suspecting her husband, so she, like, didn't mention it again, so he wouldn't be bothered.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought about that, too, and that was kind of one of my themes I pulled out of it. Not only this, but several of the Victorian books we've read. I think including Moonstone and Woman in White, is when things are unpleasant.
Yeah.
We do not talk about them.
Right.
Like, the reason Rosalie wasn't mentioned is because it might upset Mrs. Anderton.
Yeah.
And so they just don't bring it up. It could bring up some unpleasantness for her. It was this, I don't know if I should bring this up. Because I read half the Moonstone, right?
Oh, Moonstone.
So it's like, we'll get to this more next time. But one of the characters is terminally ill. And the prescription is, don't think any serious thoughts. Like, only read frivolous novels, you know, distract yourself.
Yes.
And that's the prescription from the doctor?
Yeah.
But you see this over and over again, and... I don't know, how much do you feel like this carries over into modern life, or does it, that the way one might not bring up unpleasantness?
Yeah, I mean, so, like, have you ever tried to shield others from information that you think is too hard for them to hear or to bear, or have people ever tried that with you?
I'm really bad at this. I'm notoriously bad at it. I'm what's called a blurter. I blurt things and people say, why did you say that? And I'm like, oh, I didn't know this was unpleasant for you. Sorry.
Do you really not know it's unpleasant, or did you
blurt
it?
Those things are almost synonymous.
Okay, because like afterward, did you think like, oh, that would be uncomfortable for them?
Occasionally, I'm like, Sarah, what? but a lot of times I don't know. Mm-hmm. I really don't. And many, many times, I think I'm saying what's obvious to everyone in the room.
Yeah.
And then I find out that that was not appropriate. So, yeah, I guess there's a little bit of complication to that. But I have noticed from being a blurter that many people will say, like, Sarah?
Yeah.
That's rude. That's not nice. That's this or that. And sometimes I see it, and sometimes I need them to explain it for me, but but I do know it's a thing to not say certain things.
Yeah.
And even, like, it doesn't matter if it's malicious or not.
Right.
It's, you just don't speak about it.
Yes. Well, and so I'm trying to think of the name of the show. It's Vera. It's on BBC, and it's Vera. And the entire mystery series of Vera, and if you've not seen it, please just you will love it. If you're listening to this podcast, you will love Vera. The entire premise of it is people not telling other people key things. So like in every single episode, like you could have a drinking game, like aha, hid that info, oh, didn't share that, like you, it's crazy. They, every single person to the person, lies to the police, they lie to their partners, they lie to, it's like,
is it believable? Like, does it
seem
like
it's extremely well done, but after a while you're like, okay, wouldn't it be like really cool and interesting if someone actually told the truth in one of these books? Yeah. It's like, but everybody's shielding. Well, I didn't think that was important information to share. Well, I didn't want my wife to find that out. Well, I didn't think that you needed that because I thought it would distract you from finding the real killer. Like, everybody's got this motive of wanting to control a situation through the information they do or do not share.
Yeah.
And I think this is integral to the mystery form, because if we're told every single thing by every character, you know, we're basically, you know, we know everything. And there's no real mystery there.
Well, and to not to bring up not saying stuff,
mm-hmm.
that really got to me with Rosalie herself, because mm-hmm. she said so little, people didn't even think she spoke English.
Which she did.
She speaks perfect English. She's English.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like she's hardly left England. But,
yeah,
you know, she's terrified of her husband, but she never says to anyone,
mm-hmm.
I'm a slave.
Right.
You know, like,
maybe he has her so mesmerized.
Help me.
She even marries him. So
yeah, that's he's never got her explained so at all. Much.
It's not explained. And so she's so under his control. I guess he, you know, he said, I'm going to mesmerize you into marrying me. But he could not mesmerize her into showing less disdain.
Yeah, mesmerize her into loving him or anything.
Yes, like, what, if you're gonna do it, like, go whole hog. Like, why?
She looks terrified to yeah. every stranger she meets.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, okay, so there's this housemaid in the story named Sarah. Sorry, Sarah. And she confesses to poisoning Rosalie to avoid being blamed for tasting marmalade.
She stuck her finger in some marmalade, folks. Which, this was funny, because this got me also. But Perrin was trying to get her to steal stuff for, like, ever. He was leaving stuff out. He was leaving mm-hmm. it open.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not doing it. She was turning her life around. She yeah. wasn't going to steal anything. In fact, she's like, it just seemed like things were being planted. It was so odd, but I never did. And then they left this marmalade open, and he jumped in right as she stuck her finger in it and, like, threatened her.
Yeah. And she was so grateful he gave her another chance. All she had to do was admit to poisoning his wife, and she could get sort of a decent recommendation for her next job.
Well, that was kind of a tricky thing. And this took me a minute to get, because I think a lot of the stuff with the drugs and such being used, it's just we don't use them, and we don't use them in that way.
Mm.
But this particular thing seemed to be, well, they called it an emetic, or yeah. like, I was thinking like some kind of aperitif, you know, like something that some people take for digestion that might be in their medicine cabinet.
And an emetic, I think, is going to clear out your system.
Yeah. And that's so when they were playing it as a trick, that's what I thought, like, oh, she was trying to give her diarrhea as a trick. That's
sure.
the ploy. But yeah. she had like an allergic reaction, which nobody could have anticipated. So, but it was a little ridiculous. Be like, oh, well, I'll let you go on the marmalade.
Yeah.
If you admit to, like, administering drugs to my wife.
Yeah. I had a hard time with that one. And she was completely behind the Baron. So it seemed like there are a few people who called the Baron into question. A lot of the women.
Not many.
Especially working class women were like, all about the Baron. Like, oh, what a loving husband. What an amazing man. Oh, so kind. His wife, oh, well, she always seemed scared of him. I didn't really like her.
I thought about, yeah, I really waffled about that. I wanted to see what you thought. Like, because we read, you know, we read Dickens, and in that you see a lot of working class women get
yeah.
beat up
yeah.
by their husbands.
Yes.
That, I don't know, maybe that was a prevalent form of interaction. They get snowed by someone that he definitely was flattering all of them. You could see the
yeah.
the flattery, like, oh, I never touched that. Let mm-hmm. nurses do their job. And the nurse is like, that's right. Let me do my job.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But so he, you know, he's employing flattery. He's like treating them with gentlemanly manners.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have poor home lives, and, you know, they look at this behavior with envy.
Yeah.
And they think, what's going on with this dumb lady? Doesn't
yeah.
she know the prize she's got? He bought her, after all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the other part of me just found it unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's like, come on, you're a lady. You know what it's like to be afraid of your husband. Do
yeah.
you really not? Do you think you're seeing the whole story here?
Yeah.
Might you think something else is going on?
We have a male author.
Yes.
And a male investigator is, I guess, there's not really a protagonist. If there is, maybe it's the Baron. I don't know. But we have a guy leading the charge on this investigation who is Ralph Henderson. And I don't know, like, several of these women seemed confused, but I don't know. I wondered if this was more the hand of the author who just... I think that's part of it, too, in this particular book, is what suits the book. So I have to leave some of these mysteries unanswered because we're going to go down rabbit holes, and I don't really, as the author, care about these particular directions. And I need these women to be behind him because I need people to understand how, like, mesmerizing he was as a presence, even when he wasn't hypnotizing
yeah.
someone. I don't know. It's it was, to me, it was very odd. I had a lot of open questions. One thing I appreciated in this book that I didn't get in Wilkie Collins' Woman in White or in the Moonstone, which we're going to read next. These characters often didn't remember every single word. They didn't remember every single thing. What was I doing? Where was I on that day? That always, that perfect recall in Wilkie Collins' books where the characters are like, okay, well, for 4 hours we discussed this and I'm going to tell you every single line of dialogue that came out of everybody's mouth in the exact order. And I'm going to tell you everything about the scene and what people did. And it's, to me, that's hard to believe. I see that also, though, like on a Law and Order or something where that, you know, detectives come and they're like, okay, where were you 2 months ago Thursday? And they're like, oh, on that day at 2 o'clock, I left work and I picked up my daughter. And then we went to, and I'm like, I don't know what I did yesterday at 2 o'clock.
If you, that actually came up and I was like, did that happen this week or last week?
I know.
I think this week because,
For me, it's like, oh my God, that happened today. Like, that was this morning.
Then I got really nervous and I was like, did I pay my nanny the wrong amount? Maybe it was last week that happened. I actually need to go back and check now.
Yeah. Whereas, like, in Wilkie Collins' books, there's perfect recall. And
well, there was a couple characters mm-hmm. in Woman in White towards mm-hmm. the end when he was trying to establish the dates that are like, they didn't know.
Yeah.
And that created this tension in the novel because yeah. he really needed to establish these dates.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but yeah, like
the exception
of the characters here, like, I don't know. I can't remember anything at all.
Yes.
My husband does that for me.
My husband's in charge of the remembering.
I know. That's, I'm almost quoting.
And so, yeah, like, and the Baron did not seem, I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, I would have to be in the room with the Baron to see how mesmerizing he was as a presence. But from this sort of distanced reporting and account, I was like, how does he have this power over people? And so let me just say what you and I were hinting at before, Sarah, which is this case from beginning to end is predicated on our ability to believe that there is a twin connection so deep that the illness of one can cause the illness of another, and that a Baron can use hypnosis to basically kill somebody, to have, for example, his wife drink acid. So, I mean, do you think readers in the 19th century would have read this and said, wow, yep, I'm on board? Or, and what about readers today?
Yeah, I almost wonder if at the time it was more like sci-fi, you know, like this is a new, I think hypnotism is, I've never been hypnotized, but it's still a thing where people are like, oh, certain people are more susceptible to it. And maybe it helps with smoking, this or that. And
yeah.
you know, has found its niche. Whereas at the time, it sounds like it was new, it was emerging, people found it really mysterious. Mm-hmm. You know, same with twins. Like, yes. We know there's some interesting connections there, but also they've sort of found their niche. Whereas I don't know at the time that maybe people found, like, well, these things might be possible. We haven't probed the limits of these sorts of relationships and powers. I noticed also at the time, and I thought of this, they talked about mesmeric fluid.
Yeah.
Which really reminded me, so when I was in physics class, you know, talking about how particles and waves travel, it was thought for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
You need a medium for things to travel through.
Sure.
And so it was thought that the universe was not a vacuum. It was filled with ether.
Okay.
And that's how things traveled. They traveled through the ether. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that's kind of the thought process here, that there must be something traveling on waves through a medium, the ether, and there are these, it's the mesmeric fluid, and you just can't see it. Like, you can't. They spent years trying to prove that there was ether.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Before finally being like, I guess there isn't. We really can't detect the thing. But you just thought you had to have it.
Yeah. Yeah. So with this book, it helps to suspend disbelief in certain places in order to follow the story. Because if you start the book saying, okay, I know this guy did it, because it's not a whodunit, it's a howdunit. We know it's the Baron. Literally from the first pages, we know it's the Baron. If we start the book and say hypnosis is not real, and that's crazy, and this whole sense of twin connection and all of that is not real, I think you'd have a hard time following the book in it with any engagement.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that willing suspension of disbelief would help. I think these were two topics that at the time when this book was written, 1865, it was published, I believe, these would have been very interesting topics of the day. And so the author is capturing like the sorts of conversations people are having and putting it in this book. It's a potentially difficult sell. I wanted to see like the hypnosis. I wanted to see what happens when he hypnotizes his wife, who then in turn is the medium who hypnotizes Mrs. Anderton. I wanted to see all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. It's making me think of kind of other sci-fi books that I've read, you know, like maybe the Ender series is an example where it really depends a lot on like traveling at the speed of light and on quantum theory that at some future date you might look at that and be like,
yeah,
we know so much more about that now, that just looks like silly and ridiculous. It's not, I can't suspend disbelief for that. I wonder if that's the sort of thing at the time that you're like, yeah, maybe that, what if that's possible? Holy moly.
I think too, so Ralph Henderson does not believe in all of this mesmerism and twin connections necessarily. He calls it into question over and over and over again. And I think that helps build a stronger case because he's not sold on it to start. He's not trying to prove that these things exist. He's just the facts, ma'am. He's just trying to capture information. And so when his case basically points to mesmerism as a key to three murders, I think the reader might be more inclined to believe it. And also a couple of the witnesses, Dr. Marsden, Mrs. Ellis, who's a sick nurse who is mesmerized by the Baron, they don't believe in mesmerism. In fact, they scoff at it. And yet the story they tell strongly suggests mesmerism.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to bring up the nurse, too. Mm. This was another one that, to me, sort of broadly related.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this will come up in the Moonstone. So I'm obviously thinking of, like, the two. This is why I don't read two books at the same time.
Yes.
Actually. But you'll see in the Moonstone, certain characters feel themselves above reason for different reasons. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't subscribe to that reason because I've got blah. Mm-hmm. And so you have the sick nurse here right? She's like, I never fall asleep in like 20 years of nursing.
Yeah.
And I don't believe in hypnotism. And then he made her fall asleep like
five times,
like at will. And then she kept falling asleep every single time Rosalie got sick.
Yeah.
And she's like, didn't happen. Not, I just don't know why, but it's not that. It's mm-hmm. not hypnotism. Mm-hmm. Is that believable? Do we do that? Are we like so wrapped into our own framework that we...
Well, what if something's so outside your belief system that you just refuse to believe it? So you're going to look for some other culprit. Maybe I'm not sleeping very well at night. Maybe I'm sick. Maybe...
Yes, she's like drinking caffeine to stay awake.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if something is just completely outside the realm. So, like, you know, you see these movies, right, where the space alien arrives and the person confronts the space alien and there's a degree of shock. It's either like they pass out from shock or they're like, oh my gosh, you're a space alien, like, or something in between, right? For me, I'm pretty sure I'd be passed out. The space alien would fan me. I would wake up. I'd pass out again. Like, this would just keep going on and on because it's so outside my...
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's so outside that you just wouldn't believe it if you saw it? Is it an alien? Or would you really be like, so there's an alien?
No, I would not be the, oh, hey, cool, alien. What's your name? No, I'm Carol.
Well, you wouldn't be cool with it, but would you be like, not an alien and try and pull off his alien costume?
Oh, no, you know? No, I would be passed out. You can't pull off somebody's so alien you costume. So you'd believe
it was
out.
An alien.
I would believe something outside of my belief system or my understanding of the world is happening. And my little heart couldn't
it's
take
just
it.
Just failed to process. Be like, I can get to this being outside, but yeah. I can't process it more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just like, what are the things that seeing is not believing?
Yeah. That's one example. there was some movie, I don't remember, maybe the 80s, where nuclear holocaust happened. It was on, you know, regular TV, ABC or CBS or something. And so I was young and watching this show. And then that night, I woke up in the middle of the night, probably having nightmares about watching this show, and looked out the window and the streetlights were out. So basically the electricity was out in my neighborhood. It was a hot summer night and something happened. But for some period of time, child me stared out the window thinking like, okay, it happened. It's done. We're done. You know, like this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't run to my parents' room. I didn't try to find evidence to the contrary. I just stared out the window like, oh my God, you know, the world is.
So you believed it. You did believe it.
I think I did. Yeah.
You know, this may be a terrible example, but one of the things that popped into my head is sometimes when people abuse children, I know that's one thing. People struggle with believing about family members and loved ones. They're like, no, you're lying.
Yes.
That did not happen.
Mm-hmm. Either in the moment, like a child could report something, or adult person says, you know, 20 years ago, my second cousin or my, you know, uncle or whoever the person is, our, you know, neighbor did this thing. And, you know, people are like, wait a minute now, like, because they don't have context for believing it. They think they know a person and a person could not have done that thing.
Yeah, we think sometimes we have a, and that's what I thought in this book a lot, is like, does everyone really have that much faith in their evaluation of the Baron's character that they will just ignore that his wife is afraid of him.
Right.
Maybe we do. Maybe we do just have that amount of faith in how
we
evaluate other people.
Or if we see this like really charming guy and this really cold, you know, practically silent, keep in mind, some characters don't even know she speaks English.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, we make this first impression of people and we're like, that's who he is. That's who she is, and it fits into some sort of structure in our brains of how relationships work, and we think we got it. We're like, I get this, and then we move on. And so other stuff contradicts that initial assessment, but that initial assessment is so branded on our brains, I think.
Yeah. I do, I mean, I I guess I'm just working through some of this as I read the book and I think, not believable. But then if you just think about, okay, as a human trait, we do these things.
Yeah.
I think it does make it maybe a little bit more believable.
Yeah. Yeah. The book ends with this line, supposing a series of crimes was committed, are crimes thus committed susceptible of proof, or even if proved, are they of a kind for which the criminal can be brought to punishment? And I thought that was really interesting because this insurance investigator put a crazy amount of effort into building this case. And what does he have at the end? He's basically, for all intents and purposes, proven mesmerism and what's the word I'm looking for? The Baron basically killed three people.
Yeah.
Can he? But who's going to believe that he used mesmerism to kill people? So what is this case that was built?
Well, that is interesting. I liked the cop character. That was one of my favorite characters. Was mm-hmm. this cop? Mm-hmm. And oh yeah, in here Edward Reading.
Yeah.
He doesn't. I mean. He kind of ignores that whole aspect and he goes in and he's like, yeah. Well, that was interesting. I've seen plants before and that sure sounded like a plant.
Yeah.
So I investigated further and I was like, oh, he's left-handed. So it mm-hmm. wouldn't have even fallen on that side of the bed. It would have fallen on the other side of the bed.
There's this note that is mysteriously found when the Baron goes
like
back into
the
room.
Label of the poison.
Right. And he... Even though the room had been cleaned and people were pretty sure nothing was on the floor, the Baron goes in and finds it. And the police sergeant is not buying it.
Right. Yeah. He basically disproves and casts suspicion on the Baron pretty mm-hmm. clearly as like, oh, your glove was right by it. Oh, you sent her. And he actually seems, whereas everyone else in the book seems to have no concept of human character or behavior.
Yeah.
He seems to have a really good one. He kind of reminded me a little bit of Inspector Bucket.
Inspector Bucket, and in the Moonstone, we're going to see Inspector Cuff. And yes. I think they're these three guys, Sergeant Redding, I guess is probably how it's said, Sergeant Redding, Inspector Bucket from Bleak House, Inspector Cuff from the Moonstone, they're all kind of like of one school.
Yeah. Which they get human character and human nature. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of what the Baron does, he'll kind of do these obvious ploys like, you know, like, oh, I would never cast suspicion on my best friend. I'm sure it's not that. And thereby, like, plant suspicion in this really obvious way.
Yeah.
But the inspector, he's like, he doesn't buy any of it.
Yeah.
You know, he sees right through it. And so the burden of proof is really interesting mm-hmm. here, because you might say, like, well, that's highly suspicious. Mm-hmm. You know, he says he's going in to Mr. Anderton's room to let him know that he'll probably get off the hook.
Yeah.
And please, no one disturb him all night. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, Anderton leaves a note basically without hope. So somebody told him that he was going to be convicted and he just... Right. Decided to commit suicide and just happenstance got his hands on poisons that the Baron left there. Accidentally. We know it's an accident because he sent someone looking for it. Yeah. You know, it's pretty flimsy without the mesmerism.
Yes, agreed. And it takes someone like the inspector, the insurance inspector or Sergeant Redding to really see what's happening, to kind of cut through all of the machinations, really. Like, the Baron is a master manipulator. He can make a lot of people do whatever he wants them to do.
Yes. And I think, okay, well, I don't know if that's enough proof to, like, convict him of murder, but it's certainly more proof than that Rosalie is Mrs. Anderson's sister and should receive the £25,000. There's zero proof of that.
Exactly.
So I guess I don't know how proof worked in Victorian times.
I was wondering that too, because I've even thought that with the Woman in White, where we have these two half sisters, and you know Laura, and we have Anne, yes, Catherick.
Yeah. Well, Anne Catherick is the Woman in White.
The Woman in White, and her sister half sister is Laura.
Oh, right. Gotcha.
And like, how do you prove?
I was thinking of Miriam.
Yeah, they aren't running DNA tests. Like, how do you prove? Well, then you've got to get into, do they have any papers of their birth? Okay, you know, maybe they do, and we find them, and we can see they were born on the same day in the same town, or I don't know. I think it's really interesting. I would think there's tons of open-ended questions. Yeah. And we even discussed this a little bit when we were reading The Purloined Letter, Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Purloined Letter, also a podcast episode for everybody listening.
Episode two.
And like at one point, the police inspector writes a check to Dupin, the amateur detective. And I'm like, how did that stand up in a bank? Like, I don't know. I thought a lot of it was just sort of felt sort of open-ended, and I don't know.
Yeah, I remember when like Hartwright married Laura, and I was like, well, who did he marry? Like, did he use her name? Yeah. Did everyone know she escaped the asylum? Exactly. She's supposed to be dead.
Yeah.
You married a dead person? Do they not check these things? Maybe not.
And so, readers, that is The Woman in White, which we focused on last month. And we have two podcast episodes on The Woman in White.
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting book. Such an interesting book. And Sarah, tell us what we're reading next.
Well, next, I think we're going to be reading The Moonstone, unless Carolyn comes at me with some other chronologically appropriate book.
It's
The Moonstone.
It is, and it's our second Wilkie Collins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good so far. I have to say, if you listen to The Woman in White, you heard me struggle a little bit with how the entire plot line hinges on women being incompetent at stuff. But so far, I haven't had the same struggle with The Moonstone, and I've really been enjoying going through it.
I enjoyed The Moonstone. It's a very different book than The Woman in White. You know, there is a jewel stolen in India by a British officer, and basically there's sort of a curse on this stone, and we see what happens as the stone transfers hand to hand, and we try to locate the stone. Where is this thing and who stole it? And so we try to track it and trace it. And it's pretty interesting story, very different. My take on The Woman in White was a little different than Sarah's, though I see where she's coming. I loved Marion Helcombe so much that I don't know. I had never seen that character before in Victorian literature, so I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's totally appropriate. That's why we're doing these podcasts, is you're looking at the development. And
yes. So
it was very cool.
Yeah.
And I just want to reiterate our thanks to our listener of the month.
Taya. Thank you Taya, for being our listener of the month, Taya.
Thank you, listener, for listening.
Yes, from all over the globe.
Thank you, worldwide audience.
Yeah, worldwide, throughout various places in the U.S. and Switzerland. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But next, Canada and Mexico.
Canada, we're coming for you.
We're coming for you, Canada. All right. See you next month.